Looks and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a...
Welcome to Books and Beyond. This is your host, Alison, and I'm joined today by the writer, Danielle Hawkins. And Danielle is on the line from Otorohanga. Kia ora, Danielle.
Hi. Hi, Alison.
Lovely to have you with us today. Hey, how's the weather down your way? Is it a bit chilly today?
It is, but it's a gorgeous crystal day. It's beautiful.
Oh, those autumn days are just perfect, aren't they?
Yeah.
Good on you. Hey, now, Danielle has just released her latest book, and it's called Two Shakes of a Lamb's Tale, The Diary of a Country Vet, published by HarperCollins. So congratulations, Danielle.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I've read the book and I really loved it. So now, Danielle, you're a country vet, so you work with large and small animals. You're a mother, a farmer, a wife, a family member, a gardener, and a best-selling author. And so this book, it's a diary through the four seasons of 2020. And boy, what a year that was, wasn't it, with drought and pandemic, etc. So I wanted to ask you, Danielle, this book is quite different to your previous four books, which were best-selling novels, and they'd been described as contemporary rural stories. So what gave you the idea to do a diary?
Well, really just that I was asked to. My publisher sent an email saying, hey, you know, do you think you might like to try some non-fiction? That's a good niche in the market at the moment. And so I thought about it for a little while and then thought, gosh, you know, that'd be fun. And quite easy writing non-fiction compared to writing fiction, because you don't have to try and think about story arcs and plots, which is not my strength.
Yeah, and I guess you're not having to make up who did what to whom and all that sort of thing. It just is what it is, isn't it? Yeah, and because what I really like about your writing, and particularly in this book, it's so witty and warm and observant. And so I was wondering if you were a sort of person who always sees the funny side of any situation.
Oh, not necessarily. I can definitely hold a grudge as well as the next person.
All right.
But actually, that was a sort of benefit of writing this. You look for the funny stuff and the nice stuff that happens every day, and of course, the more you look for it, the more of it you find. So,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, an unintended consequence. Yeah.
And exactly.
This book, it reminded me a lot of Alison Pearson's book that was called I Don't Know How She Does It, which is an urban version of your book, but her character doesn't...
It was a bit grimmer, though.
Yeah, that's right, I know. Yeah, and I don't think her character does as much as you do, anyway. I'm glad you've read it, because I was going to say, if you hadn't, maybe in your spare time, you're right, you might want to read it.
But I did read it, but she annoyed me a little bit, that woman. She made her life so much harder than it had to be.
Yeah, actually, that's true, isn't it? And I think she's caught controversy a little bit, too, in some of her social media these days. But and then, of course, others have compared you to the James Herriot books. And I guess, would you have read those when you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I am a vet. Yeah. I love those books.
Yeah. Oh, look, I'm not surprised there. Yeah. And when I started reading the book, I was just hooked from the first entry, and it was about being at the school bus stop, and it was maternal fashion reached a new low this morning. And I thought, what a brilliant way to start the book, because I think most women and men, and you know, even country, city folk like myself, I think we can all relate to it. You know, the pressure that is on people to do everything and look immaculate at the same time. I think I'd love to just wear a Chiefs jersey and trackies and no makeup to do the school drop-off. Yeah. But, you guys have got a good excuse. You know, you're so busy doing other stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and because as they say, motherhood is messy, isn't it? And it was a brilliant way to start the book. And then also I was going to ask you a bit about one incident with a capital I that you talk about. It's towards the end of the book. And you said we had an incident at work this morning, and it was about the little cat that bit the plastic tube in half and then inhaled it as you were trying to extubate it. And I thought, oh my God, talk about better work stories.
And yes, that was appalling.
Yeah.
I can't believe that poor cat lived. She did, thank goodness.
Yes, well, thank goodness.
Yeah, certainly not to my due to my visionary skills. It was pure fluke.
And all those ways that you tried to think about how to retrieve the tube, I was half expecting that you were going to use the number 8 wire. But I was going to say, I was going to ask, would this sort of incident be typical of working as a country vet? Well, in some ways, how you deal with it. I mean, like, sometimes you've just got to use what you've got.
I don't think that's a country thing. I have a feeling that's in any doctor, vet, dentist, anyone who works with biological things that don't always behave like they're supposed to.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Things just go wrong sometimes.
I guess that's true. And, you know, as they say, animals and children particularly. Yeah, and then of course, you know, that's a small animal that you were dealing with, and then as when you're a large animal vet, too, that's a really sort of challenging role, because how many people are likely to get kicked in the head as they're attempting to castrate their patient? you've got to be, you must have to be so fit and strong. And so I was wondering if, you know, if you're trying to do an intimate examination on something like a bull, do you always have people around that can help you?
Almost always, yes. You almost always have a farmer to help, so that's really good. And people tend to have pretty good facilities. Most of the absolute, like, totally turning to custard stories are in lifestyle blocks where they don't have any facilities, and then everything just becomes a circus.
Right. Yeah.
But if you've got good yards, you know, you can do pretty much anything.
Right. Oh, that would make sense. And I guess the lifestyle blocks, often those people wouldn't have as much experience anyway, and, the actual farmers themselves. So
Yeah, that's right. So it's a bit of a double whammy. They don't have a good setup. I can see why. If you've only got one steer, it's expensive to build a lot of stuff. And then you don't know what to do with it and where to stand.
Yeah. Oh, I can see it going horribly wrong. And of course, when you're, if you're lying in the mud and trying to deliver something out of a cow or insert something into an animal, that it's not like it's a sterile and working environment, is it? You're lying, with all that mud and...
Cows are amazing. Cows can handle anything.
Really?
Horses and people, we die at the drop of the hat, but cows are awesome.
Oh, really? Oh, see, I didn't know that. It's fascinating. There's so much that we up here in the city, we don't know these things. But, cows are pretty awesome animals, aren't they? But, and so it's almost like you work in two worlds. So you've got your clinic work and your paddock work, and that, quite different places, I guess.
Yes, although a lot of our clients are rural people, so you don't tend to have quite so much of the sort of inner city expectations, which is a slightly different story.
Yes, I think I know a little bit about those too. Yeah, and speaking of cities, the book's kind of really does describe that bit of disconnect between urban and rural folks. And it was so funny when your friend came over from inner city Sydney and she said something about, oh, I really envy your life. It's so peaceful and stress-free. you know, and talk about not reading the room. You know, because
I remember that all my life. I remember it when I was a little girl, you know, and people would come down because Mum and Dad had quite a lot of friends who lived in Hamilton and Auckland. Yeah. And, you know, they would stand and look out over the lawn and go, oh, dude, we got up at 5 o'clock so that we'd be in for lunch.
Yes. Oh, dear. Yeah. Yeah. And because I wonder if perhaps city folk don't really even realise just how hard rural folk work.
Oh, I don't ever mean to imply that you necessarily work harder or you're more worthy if you live in the country. I know that heaps of people in the city have ridiculous working days and have, you know, commutes and stuff all added on. I just wanted to explain what it was like, not to imply that it was any better or harder or anything like that than anyone else's.
Right. Yeah, actually, I know what you mean. It's different, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. It's not that it's more noble or you're an inherently better person or anything. It's just a different life.
Different. I get where you're coming from. But some of it, that particular incident reminded me a bit of a Tui ad, you know, like, oh, you must be able to pat fluffy lambs all day. You know, what a great life sort of thing. Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about kids too, that, and perhaps a bit more on that subject of how we are, life is different in the city as opposed to the country. Because, you know, sometimes I wonder these days if a lot of city kids even really know where our food comes from. But, and I was comparing that to your kids. They get such a good view of the world. Like, there's no mystery, really, eh? They know how species reproduce and where the food comes from. I kind of wonder if you'd ever want to live anywhere else.
Oh, no, of course not. And I do think it's nice to have to just understand stuff like that and things die, and it's sad, but it's not horrific. It's sad, and it's just part of life. And
Yeah, and I suppose, yeah, part of the modern world, isn't it? Yeah. And, I loved, you know, when we're talking about kids, actually, when you were trying to organise visits to and from the kids' friends during the school holidays.
And, you know, I'm sure that's the same everywhere.
I'm sure that would be. But you just described it so well, and all those combinations and permutations of families and, you know, who's got a best friend and a second best friend. And I was thinking you almost need a PhD in calculus to make that actually work.
Absolutely.
So that was hilarious. But, I mean, I think everyone will relate to that. And I'm sure, you know, with the farming life, you really do get good at logistics. But, no, that was hilarious. And, you know, with the rural life and you've got, you know, neighbours and your network, I was thinking that the rural support network that you describe in your book, that must be invaluable to you, the way, you know, that people are there to often assist with kids, stock, pets, tractors.
Oh, it is. I don't take that for granted. We've got such lovely neighbours, and you know, we've got my mum and dad just down the road, which is awesome. The kids can just bike on down and do this, and it's amazing.
That's fantastic, isn't it? And in the book, you even set up some blind dates with an unattached farmer. So that's fantastic, isn't it?
that bit wasn't strictly true.
Yeah, I wondered if that might have been a bit of poetic license, but I mean, I could see it happening, and it's
absolutely. It was a case of sort of adapting things that had happened years ago and
talking
them in.
Yeah, and you could sort of see them happening again, you know. Yeah. And in the book, you do touch a little bit on your illness and recovery, which you'd been through just before the book started. And I'm just thinking, having an illness like that, that must have added so much to the complexity of your life.
It did, in hindsight. It's funny. I'm sure everyone finds it the same. Something that was a cancer diagnosis, and you sort of get pitchforked right into chemo and doctor's appointments.
Yeah.
And, you know, but and it all changes. But you just cope with it, and we did just cope with it. It wasn't until probably a year later when everything was normal again that, yeah, all of a sudden we noticed, oh, well, this is way better, and we're not nearly so stressed.
Right, yeah.
And but at the time we didn't feel, you know, like we were, drowning or anything like that. You just sort of did it.
I guess you do, don't you, and you just put one foot in front of the other, and yeah, I guess that's
exactly
the only option, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, people tend to say, "Oh, you're very brave." You hear that a lot when people are like, "Oh, you're so brave," and it's like, "Well, you're not, because you didn't choose it. Like, you're just coping."
Yeah.
And it's great to cope, but I always feel that that's not the right word to describe it.
Yes. Yeah. I think people do tend to describe being brave and courage and all that sort of thing. But yeah. No, I hear what you're saying with that. And but it was nice to have that in the book, because so much of the book is absolutely hilarious. But you do include some touching stories and scary and heartbreaking ones too. So yeah, it really rounds out the book beautifully. But now, I've got to ask you about the literary festivals, and that, so this is sort of absurd and hilarious, but that contract that you had to sign at one of your literary festivals, and I think you said it was pages long, and it told you what you weren't allowed to do on stage. So you weren't allowed to turn up drunk, use weapons, set fires, deface property, or disrespect yourself on stage.
I know. It irritated me so much.
Did it?
Oh, that's so bureaucratic. What a waste of everyone's time.
Yeah, because it was hilarious, and it made me think, so it must be that someone has actually done some of those things before at a writer's festival.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
Yes.
Or perhaps they just hired a very expensive consultant to, you know, cover all risks, who thought that would be a good way of justifying their salary. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, but it was just absurd, wasn't it? But, you know, surely...
That festival got cancelled, so I'm going this year. I'm not sure if they'll still want me now.
Oh, right. Yes. Oh, goodness.
Maybe I might receive a brisk note.
Yes.
Don't bother.
Maybe they ran out of paper or something, printing out all the contracts. Yeah. Oh, that was hilarious, though. You know, I've noticed that, you know, you send yourself up and you send others or, you know, the festivals and the bureaucracy up so well. I think I'm allowed to say, call it taking the piss. I'm allowed to say that on the radio. But by doing so, you really make some really valid points about modern life, I guess. You know, almost how complicated we can make things. And I guess, yeah, as you say, like hiring consultants, perhaps that's not the best way of going about things.
Yes, that is one sort of major benefit of writing a book. You get to put in all your own little axes to grind.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yes, there's probably a lot of people would like to do the same thing. But I find, I think you're a really gifted storyteller, and I wondered if storytelling was part of your life when you were growing up.
Well, reading certainly was. I don't think we're a particularly, you know, oral storytelling sort of a family, but yeah, we're.
But you were.
Certainly read avidly.
Yes, you were reading.
All my childhood.
Yeah.
Yes.
And because I was kind of wondering if there'd been stories from the land, because your family have been on that land for generations, haven't they?
Mm.
And
yes.
And doing the native planting as well. So I guess there's been some stories to tell about that.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but I suppose it's just becomes part of the fabric of your life, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, there are sort of certain family stories, the one about Grandpa and the flamethrower and things like that.
Right.
Little legends, but...
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, it's really interesting having been on that piece of land for so long. It's quite a special thing, and I guess you probably feel...
Yes, it is.
Yeah, quite attached to that land.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, love it.
Yeah.
Yes, and I still sort of pinch myself that I get to live here, because, you know, I loved it growing up. But I knew I didn't want to be a farmer myself, and so I always thought, well, I'll have to leave and, you know, go somewhere else and maybe marry somebody in town or whatever. And then to, A, marry a farmer, and, B, be able to import him. It's like, whoa!
Yeah,
amazing. That's really good luck.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good, isn't it? Yeah, it's wonderful how things can sometimes work out like that. So, yeah, and you know how you were saying that you were a reader growing up? Did you always want to write?
Not really. I always enjoyed writing little stories, but I never thought of making it a career. I think my dad in particular is very sciencey, and we were brought up that science was real, and sort of arts stuff was play.
So. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't make a career out of it. You just do it for fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people would relate to that sort of parental advice that we were given. Yeah.
Well, I think it was the right advice. I mean, I'm very pleased that I'm a scientist, and that pays my wages, and then the writing's a nice extra hobby.
Yeah. Oh no, it is a good way to do things, isn't it? Now, one of your characters, I was going to ask you about your book, I've just been reading it, The Pretty Delicious Cafe. I really loved that one. And one of your characters, it's the sister called Leah in it, and she's described as never letting the truth get in the way of a good story. It's funny, some people say that about me, and I think that's not true. But I just wondered if you think that a good memoirist, especially a witty one like you, I was wondering if people use this technique somewhat. Would you embellish things?
Absolutely, yes, always, always to make them a little bit funnier, or of course to portray yourself in a slightly better light than probably actually were in real life.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, no. I'm sure everybody does it, but I certainly do.
Yeah. It's I think it is. It's a good technique, isn't it? And it means that it can add a bit more drama or a bit more sort of humour.
Well, that's right. The problem is that most people are very nice, which is great. That's a really nice way to live. But it's not particularly interesting if every character is absolutely delightful. So you just have to put in a few nasty ones here and there.
Yeah, I guess.
It's a little more satisfying.
Yeah. And I think I was saying that to another author, actually. Yeah, and if the place you're living is perfect and the sun's always shining and there's plenty of water and all that sort of thing, the story's probably not as interesting, is it?
No, that's right. Apart from making everybody feel a bit sick.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. But look, we do live in a pretty amazing place. And I've noticed that your books have been translated into German. And so it sounds as though you must have quite a fan base amongst the German people.
Well, they didn't want the last couple, so it can't be that big a fan
base. Really? I didn't know that.
Well, presumably it doesn't sell on its hundreds of millions, but also they've had a bit of a law change over there where they pay the translators differently and rather more than they used to. So they're not translating so many things from English as they used to.
Oh, goodness, yes. Oh, it's always the money that gets in the way of these things, isn't it? Because I'd been thinking about this, and I had wondered what was it about... if you had any ideas why a rural New Zealand novel would be attractive to the German reader.
Well, somebody did tell me once, and I can't even remember who it was, but you know how we perhaps like books about women who go to the south of France and buy a rundown vineyard?
Oh,
the
yes.
The German version of that is the... that's a sort of a nice daydream for them.
Right. I can sort of see that. And, you know, because we have, when we had tourists in the country, you'd often see lots of German tourists, wouldn't you? So I guess we are an interesting place for them to visit and I guess also to read about.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Interesting. Hey, now I have to ask this. I'm sure people probably ask you this all the time, but how do you fit your writing into your day? Because it's like every day you've got a million things to do.
I'm not doing terribly well at that at the moment. I'm only writing very slowly, but early in the morning is the time. So I get up early and do an hour and a half before everyone else gets up.
Right. Oh, that sounds as though that could be a good time when there's a bit of peace and quiet,
yeah.
I guess.
I'm a sort of early bird rather than a night owl sort of a person. But and my brain is by far at its best. Not that its best is that great, but the best it gets is best thing in the morning.
Yeah. Would that be quite common amongst farmers that you become an early bird?
Oh, I don't know. I know lots of dairy farmers who get up at 4:30 very, very unhappily.
Oh, right.
I think it might be more just the way you're born and then you sort of impose your lifestyle over the top of it.
Right, yeah. Oh, cool. And I'm just wondering if you're planning to keep on writing.
Yes.
That is...
Always is fun.
Yes. Oh, great. Yeah. Oh, I'm so pleased because we'll be looking forward to seeing what comes out next. Do you think you would continue along the lines of that? You know, they do call yours a rural romance, don't they? Are you sort of thinking of more of those, if you're allowed to say, of course?
Yes, absolutely. No, I haven't got a contract or anything. I do like books where everything ends happily. Like, that's just what I think I would always want to write. But on the other hand, I do kind of feel like I might have told all of the stories about girls a bit like me who live in places a bit like where I live. there's only so many possible storylines and I might have told them all.
Right, yeah. So you might be looking for another angle or something.
Yeah, I'm sort of trying my hand at a fantasy fairy tale-y type of a thing at the moment.
Right, yeah. And because were you saying in one interview or somewhere I read about you that you really like Philip Pullman?
Yes, yeah, I do. I think he's wonderful.
Yeah, yes.
I would love to write something like that, but I don't think I'm clever enough. Never mind, I will keep trying.
Yeah, yes. Oh, look, we can't wait to see what happens next. Now, if we've got any budding authors out there listening, what advice would you give them?
Oh, just keep practicing. It takes a long time to get good at writing. So you know, when you write your great novel idea, it probably won't be very good. But that's okay. That doesn't mean that you won't get there. Yeah,
right.
I think it's surprising how much practice you've got to do before it starts coming out sounding a little bit polished and professional.
Right, yeah. Oh, that's really good advice, and I'm pretty sure others would say similar things. Well, look, Daniel, this has just been wonderful talking to you today. So to our listeners, I've been speaking with author Danielle Hawkins about her new book, Two Shakes of a Lamb's Tale, The Diary of a Country Vet. It's so warm and witty, and look, I really highly recommend that people buy a copy or two from their local bookstore. store, particularly with Mother's Day coming up. It would be a really great one to buy for all the mums in your life, and I'm planning to do that for my mum. Hope she's not listening. Now, thank you so much for your time today, Danielle, and all the very best for this book.
Thanks so much, Alison. See you later.
Bye for now.